Fox. And for those of you that have not read the press yet today, there was an unfortunate tragedy there where the animal in question somehow got out of its cage and then was subsequently shot by a bow and arrow hunter. So the animal is deceased, but the animal owner still asked if they could speak today. So still getting queued up there?
I am. My name's Cody. Thank you for having me. Thank you for considering this. There he is smiling right there. This is the one I wanted to show you right away. There's a lot of research that's been going on about these animals that I want everyone to know about. I want to help with it. They're amazing companions. I wanted to come here today, even though I lost them, and explain to you guys, everyone here, that this is an animal that should, at the very least, be considered in a sort of situation that you would think about a dog or a cat or cockatiel or these, you know, other pets. So I have no vested interest anymore, unfortunately, with the things that have transpired. But he's been an amazing pet. He's great. This is him when he was just a little guy. Couldn't even...
Here, buddy. Gotta make it.
Couldn't even get over, like, the little stair at my house. So, there in 1959, a man by the name of Dmitry Konstantin Bylyv did research that was later on in 2005, or 2010, sorry, recognized by the National Geographic as one of the most mind-blowing genealogical studies that had helped us understand why animals, like dogs, came from wolves, and how that aspect and the domestication of them had become our pets, our buddies. I don't know how many of you are dog owners, but you know that when you have a buddy like that, they're your buddy, just like he was. So, in summation, there should never be anybody that's allowed to just grab a fox out of the wild and put it in a cage and keep it. If they have proper documentation and seem appropriately suitable to take care of it, it's a pet. It's not a wild animal. There is wild animals, there's wild foxes, and there's domesticated foxes. And I encourage any of you to look up any information that intrigues you to look it up. I was intrigued enough to buy one and take care of it since he was this big, fit in my hand like that. And I drove 8 hours with him in my belly here just to like make sure that, you know, he knew I was watching out for him, and he was my guy. So, take that into, think about that. You know, I've looked at the city ordinances and what you guys, what has been predetermined, and he wasn't That animal wasn't bundled in with jackals and dingoes and hyenas and whatever other kind of Canidae is this genus. I get it. You gotta kind of make a predetermined aspect of, you know, what you're okay and not okay with having in the city, but he's a good animal. He should be welcome here.
If you don't mind, I'd like to just ask a couple questions. Most of my knowledge is based on what I read in the newspaper. This is an animal that was bred to be domesticated. It mentioned like a lineage of domestication. And then, so that's one question. And the second was, how are they documented? What sort of papers, or I'm assuming they're inoculated and so forth, but beyond that, are there some sort of certain certification or papers that come with the animal?
You, from the specific breeder that I purchased him through, you can choose to have paperwork that not only certifies his lineage, but also his health. So, and I did that. I chose to purchase that extra certificate, which was very minimal. It's only $25 to do, but I wanted to know that he was healthy first and foremost. I had no idea that any of this type of scenario would be something that came into effect. So, you can do that. I know that his particular lineage and his parents before his parents and all that, they were all domesticated animals. Unfortunately, the prepubescence of that type of paperwork for that animal is not lengthy enough for it to be like a canine. Like, what is it? Like Katie. You can get animals certified, so you know you're paying a lot of money for a purebred animal or whatever. They don't do that for this animal.
Okay. So it's not unlike a purebred animal that you would purchase from a noteworthy breeder and with papers and so forth to go with the animal. Other questions from council?
Sure. I guess when this first came up, my first question was to staff, you know, what is staff's recommendation on this? And I don't know if we've gotten that back yet.
I
from animal control, we didn't get any response back. I didn't, okay. No response right now. They wondered how they would fit in with the dog, I suppose, and it was picked up and put in there in the pound. But
the other thing I did is I got a note from the professor of wildlife ecology at RCTC, who mentioned that he strongly supported that the silver fox be allowed as a pet in Rochester. It's not a friendly wild animal, it's domesticated. And he's willing to come in and be an expert witness or consultant on the issue. So that was the take from the only expert that I heard back on.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Campion.
So along the lines of expert testimony, I did receive an email from a Dr. Longren, who's the certified wildlife biologist, associate professor, and wildlife extension specialist through the University of Minnesota Crookston. And I'll summarize it. His last line was, he doesn't know the specifics of the situation in Rochester, but would recommend we proceed with great caution. His email was really a laundry list of concerns about what we would do going forward and the best interest of the community. So if there is an opportunity to maybe bring this back to at a COW where I could get back and forth with him with a little bit of information, maybe figure out if there's a spot versus trying to hash it out today.
Well, just for sake of discussion, are there a few bullet items that you could in terms of cautionary?
Sure. And I guess I'll throw out there what he says. So this, again, is paraphrasing his language. He says, dogs have been under domestication for thousands of years and still present occasional dangers to people. A, quote, domestic fox, unquote, is likely the result of domestication of less than 100 years and is still, in his opinion, quite wild. And then he goes on to ask questions that are a little bit more thought-provoking about what happens with other type of animals that people would claim are...
I'm very intrigued. And, pardon me for interrupting. But I'm very intrigued that he takes that effort to think about how an animal that we both accept as a domestic dog, as a dog, that took this person, this genealogist, 4 years to create an animal that was genetically, its ears were different, they were droopy ears, its bone structure was different, it was genetically different than a wild fox.
Yeah, Cody, I'm not going to argue with you about that issue because, frankly, I'm ill-prepared today to debate the mechanics of what domesticates a fox and what the...
I've had the conversation before. I don't mean to.
And I appreciate that, and I'm willing to continue your testimony, but if you're looking at me to debate it, I'm probably the wrong guy to be having a debate with.
Getting the level set here. Mr. Pickey?
So, I don't think there's any decision today, and I don't think we're even looking for direction. I think this, as I understood, this is just for information, and I think we've gotten that. I think we're probably ready to proceed.
All right. Any comments, Mr. Bill?
Sorry for your loss, first of all. And the only thing comments that I've received is the vaccinations and records of that nature that would be kept if we ever...
I can provide it anytime you'd like. And also the documentation that he was healthy out of the gate.
Okay. Ms. Means?
I just wanted to restate what Mr. Rex said, and that is, I'm so sorry, Cody, because your pets are like the family. So, my sympathy.
Yeah, man. You ever heard that song? What does the fox say? This is what they say.
Yeah, I do have one question. You know, the city attorney, Mr. Gosley, is here. And
that's the noise they make, at least. Sorry.
Okay. So,
The Russia's Institute of Cytology and Genetics, and was
genealogy and genetics, oncology. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was your what was your fox's name?
I cannot prove the elid. His name is Emil.
Emil.
Yeah.
Okay.
I cannot prove that he came from that institute. That that institute requires about an $8,000 price. To own one of these guys.
Okay.
I
think that was my only question.
Okay.
Yeah. I feel like there has to be a lineage because that the color of his coat is not native to the area. So.
All right. Well, thank you again for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
And
I appreciate
providing
very
information.
Much.
And
yeah.
Should the question come up again? I think we're a little bit more educated, so very much appreciate that.
Yeah.
And sorry once again.
No worries. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to item two, a review of a proposed Rochester Entertainment and Sports Arena report. Mr. Jones, are you going to leave us with this?
Yeah, I'll introduce Rob to you, but just to provide a little background. About 7 months ago, we received a great phone call and some follow-up emails regarding an opportunity, and we compiled a very small work group and started asking ourselves a lot of questions and doing some research. That phone call was from the United States Hockey League, and they were... interested in looking at Rochester as a market. We did a lot of initial research and information, brought together some great people to have a conversation, and really that led us to asking ourselves a lot of questions that we didn't have the information to. So we engaged with Rob and his company, Hammus Sports, and we asked them to take a look at this opportunity for the city. In doing that, we found some deficiencies here in terms of infrastructure when it comes to concerts, entertainment, sporting activities, and so brought us to a point to do a feasibility study, and today we want to bring the results of the feasibility study forward. I think it may have said that we have a proposal. We don't have a proposal. This is just an opportunity that we want you to look at. We think is a very very attractive public-private opportunity to pursue. And so we've done a lot of work leading up to this, and we think we've answered some of those questions. So we just want to bring it forth to you for some direction. And if we choose as a city to continue to look at this, we or others that we've had involved to this point can be as involved or not involved as you want. But we just thought it was an opportunity that we hope that you think is a good one to have a discussion about. So today I have Rob Robinson from Hammett Sports. I would also like to introduce Brad Kwong, who is with Northern Lights Hockey, and they're very involved in the development of amateur athletes and hockey and entertainment and other things. And through the course of meeting a lot of new people through this process, they're very interested in this market, and we've had some great discussions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Rob, and he can walk you through the feasibility study.
Hi, good afternoon. We have a lot of information today to cover. We're going to give you kind of an overview of the feasibility study that we've been working on for several months, as Brad outlined. I have with me also Don Detlefs from Sincolms Detlefs Architects. Don has and his company have designed about 50 of these arenas of about this size. We've worked with Don on a number of projects, and we were able to get to a lot of good concepts and information very quickly with Don. I'll introduce it, you know, just ourselves and then Don's company and also Johnson Consulting, who provided market feasibility analysis for us on this. But Hammett's company is we are a real estate development firm. We have an expertise in sports development. We do a lot of project management and owner representation project representative assignments for sports projects all over the country. We're actually right now working as the owner's rep on the Vikings project up in Minneapolis. But you can see some of our other representative projects, both large and small, that we've been involved with over the past 25 years or so. Sincolms, Don, I think personally has been involved in about at least 40 or 50 of the arenas of the type that we're going to talk to you about today. It's a very unique specialty to do it well, to do it flexibly, to make these buildings work, and to do it very affordably, and Sincolms does an excellent job of that. Again, a quick representation of some of their clients and recent projects. I mentioned Johnson Consulting. We chose Johnson Consulting because they also are quite well versed in these smaller arenas of the size we're going to talk to you about. Johnson's also based in Chicago, has a lot of very good market research and market knowledge of the Midwest, and is particularly well versed with the USHL. So as we jumped into the study, we always like to talk about, you know, sort of the statement of the problem. What are we trying to solve here? What is the driver of this study? And we quickly tried to narrow it down to, looking at what would make a new arena here part of a vibrant entertainment district that's starting to form downtown. We also realized that, you know, since there may be some public money involved in a project like this, generally there is, the public side of the equation needs to have a very good return on investment, whether that's growth downtown, new tax revenue, jobs, hotel room nights, increased overall activity downtown. Those are all the benefits that we've seen from projects like this, and we'll get into that in a little bit more detail soon. But some of the key issues we focused on here, really defining why this project needs to occur, really center on some of the deficiencies of the existing Taylor Arena. As you know, the arena was built in 1986, so it doesn't really seem that old. But the evolution of that building type has moved rather quickly, and the Taylor Arena in its present form is really not configured in a way that it's very good for hockey, certainly, but also for concerts, other family shows, and other sorts of touring events that promoters would like to bring to Rochester. The sight lines, for one thing, are difficult compared to other arenas of its size. We'll get into that in a little bit more detail in a few minutes. Operational flexibility is rather limited. It's tough to load in and load out certain shows and certainly concerts. We'll get into some more of the specifics of what can be improved in that area within the building. We also feel like there's a great opportunity with a new building in that location to engage the park that's adjacent to it for sort of an outdoor, indoor relationship with music festivals and other events that leverage off of a new arena and its infrastructure. And we'll talk about all those issues as we go through some of the design concepts that we've come up with. So the overview of the study really was to evaluate the Rochester market, sort of get a feeling of how healthy is the market, is it appropriate for USHL team, how attractive is it to concert promoters, promoters of other types of events, and to try to figure out what size of an arena would work here, what configuration would work here, how many seats would it have, what would its capabilities be. We also felt it was important to give you some idea of what certain options would cost. It's always hard to identify exact cost without a complete design, but what we've tried to do here is bracket some different arena types, sizes, configurations, and give you an idea of what those would cost in this market at this time. We'll talk a little bit about some of the positive impacts of these buildings, both from a fiscal and economic standpoint, sort of downtown activity. There are many good examples, and we'll talk about some of those. We'll also talk a little bit about next steps and what a schedule might look like if you were to decide to go forward with an arena like this, when you'd have to start design, when you might expect to finish so that hockey could be played there or other events could take place there. So we started with a market assessment with Johnson Consulting, and we really started with a kind of an economic base analysis, looked at median household income and the employment base. We also kind of evaluated this market against other USHL markets, against other concert markets, other markets with small arenas, to understand overall feasibility. We also tried to understand the demand that there might be for suites and club seats, loge boxes, things of that nature that you find in these types of arenas. We also just tried to figure out what would the overall attendance profile look like for certain types of events, and we'll get into some of those results as we move through it. But to give you just a flavor, we're going to go through these rather quickly. You can always come back to these slides. But we tried to cover a lot of ground very quickly and just understand, what kind of a market is Rochester as compared to its peers and generally to the country at large. What we found is there's a very strong level of median household income in Rochester as compared to the national average and some other nearby markets. Why that is important is because it's a good indicator for disposable income, which sort of drives the sports and entertainment business. High levels of disposable income, free up dollars that can be spent on entertainment. So there's a high correlation there. We also looked at some mapping, some tools, just to understand where income distribution is happening. You can see there's sort of a cluster of the darker orange and red zones very close to downtown Rochester, higher levels of income and ability to buy tickets for these events and to participate in what might happen in an arena like this. We also looked at the strength of the employment market. It's, employment is strong here. You have a very strong anchor employer in Mayo Clinic, and that's also a positive for USHL hockey, but also concerts, other types of events. We also looked at some of the competing arenas nearby, and what we found is that the La Crosse Center and the Verizon Wireless Center in Mankato really pick up quite a bit of the concert business, family show business, and other events in the region. And we feel like there's a great opportunity for Rochester to capture some of that market share with a new building. So getting a little more specifically into USHL markets, Rochester stacks up very favorably in terms of its population, households, median income, which we mentioned, very high relative to other USHL markets, and there are 17 of those. So you can see sort of ranks high in each of the categories as you compare it across the country. We also, looked at those markets and said, we want to understand what average attendance looks like in those markets. And if you compare that attendance to the population in those cities, what could we expect to happen in Rochester? And again, the data was very favorable. The three-year average for your basic USHL city, your typical city, is close to 3,000 per game. The red lines you see, we actually tried to adjust for markets which are very large, like Chicago, and markets which are very small, like Kearney, to try to eliminate those outliers and get a little bit better data set. And what we found that, with a reasonable assumption for attendance in this market would be around 3,000, 3,300 per game. And so I think we all felt fairly confident. And Johnson has done this analysis for other USHL teams, and they've been very close, sort of on a pro forma basis, looking forward to what attendance will be, and then the actual attendance stacks up fairly closely to that in their experience. I'll just skip through. It's more of the same sort of analysis, trying to prove out what that attendance might be for hockey here. And then we also looked at some of the other small market arenas of a similar size and, what they've done in terms of seating capacity, number of club seats, suites, things like that, to try to understand what might work here. And we'll get into a little bit more of this discussion when we get into some of the design concepts. But just wanted to give you a sense of, some of the things that stand behind the concepts before we launched into trying to, put a design together or a preliminary design together. So just in summary, we feel like, it's a very strong market. There's certainly a market for somewhere between 500 to 700 club seats, 12 to 20 suites, including some party suites, loge boxes, which give you a sense of so something between a suite and a club seat. It's kind of a smaller seating option, which Don will go through. We felt that the numbers supported that type of mix. And, you know, the numbers supporting that strong median household income, solid employer base, you know, we feel that, you know, the attendance is supported when looking at other USHL markets. You know, we feel like overall this market is strong, and the USHL is a strong league as well. We also looked at the concert market. The significance of that rectangle, the red rectangle you see at the bottom of the chart, is to identify the segment of the market, the concert market, that an arena like this would appeal to. And, you know, you're not going to get the top tier acts that are going to go into Minneapolis, but you are going to get a significant number of acts that are kind of in that range of the top 100 to 200 acts per year throughout the country. And the size of the arena is very important, and also the configuration of the arena to capture a portion of that market. This is a key indicator that 5 to 9,000 seat size for concerts, very important in order to capture some group, some portion of that 100 to 200 top grossing tours. And we'll get into what some of those key factors are, some of those characteristics, but it has to do with flexibility and rigging and the ease at which these acts can get in and out of the building. And just to give you, you know, sort of an overview of the types of events that you see in arenas of this size throughout the country, you know, everything from monster trucks to Harlem Globetrotters to, you know, the ice shows, WWE, you know, the spectrum is pretty broad and growing. And in order to attract those types of acts, the arena has to be configured in such a way that it can do all of those things, from trade shows to arena football to hockey. You know, even a lot of these arenas do boxing, but also have a number of different configurations for concerts, and Don will go through many of these as we go through the options. So to kind of boil it down, Johnson took all of that data, you know, sort of crunched the numbers and felt like they could get to a, we'll say, a worst case, base case, and best case for the number of events per year he would attract in an arena like this, like we'll go through in a market like Rochester. And, you know, we like to tend to look at the best, the base case rather, and feeling pretty comfortable with around 116 annual events. You know, the sports tenant would be a USHL team with 32 events, but the others are family shows and concerts and flat floor events like trade shows, you know, graduations, civic events, banquets, meetings, other business. A certain amount of that happens there already. In fact, this number, 30 non-tenant sports events and other events is very similar to what is happening at the Taylor Arena, but you get all these other events, you know, layered on top of that, which gets you a significant, you know, almost 380,000, close to 400,000 new visits downtown that you don't get today. So that is really the driver that gets you the additional hotel room nights and economic activity that you like to see in these buildings. So Don, I'm going to just kick off a little bit with the program overview. Come on over.
Okay.
But we originally looked at many options in trying to figure out what to build here, what would be feasible here. We looked at various sizes ranging from a 4,000 seat arena for hockey up to 6,000 and beyond. Actually, we didn't include those here, but today we're going to focus on the blue bars, which are a 4,000 seat, a 5,000 seat, and a 6,000 seat arena, rough numbers. And Don will go through kind of the pros and cons of each of those. So So Donald starts right up there, you can just flip through.
So what you're going to see today are all what we call ground level concourses, which basically you circulate around on the ground. On the last chart, the ones in white were the ones that were excluded, because you can also do an elevated concourse, but that costs a lot more, requires a lot more square footage, and quite honestly, what happens with an elevated concourse is you have a lot of the locker rooms down on the park level, so it's very park and urban unfriendly. So we've concentrated, after going through all these options with our whole client group, of looking at ground level concourses. So basically, the first is what you're going to see on a lot of these also. We have oriented the building 45 degrees because it relates better to the river and relates to your adjacent pieces. But the first one we have is 4,000 seats for hockey. So generally, when you're looking at 4,000 seats, you're going to add 1,000 or two for your maximum capacity. The other thing you're going to see about this one is it is a U-shaped configuration. So we've done this in past buildings, and we wanted to throw that as a model to see if it worked for Rochester. But what happens is you build everything around the 85 by 200 hockey rink, but that is also the setup for a lot of the traveling events that go across the U.S. Arena football, arena lacrosse, arena soccer, circus is set up with that. So that event and that size is how you usually design your bowl. So what you get in this one is a U-shaped building, seats going up each side, the ground level concourse. You can see people come out of the portals, go back up. So concourse is right at ice level in all of these, which makes it urban friendly and affordable. And then above you have suites and load suites and club seats. So it's basically a really, really tall two-story building is what you're getting when you get a ground concourse level building. That's the concourse. It's all underneath the seat, so it's a very tall concourse. You can have as many windows as you want looking out to the park, which is where we're putting it. So here's a 45-degree configuration that we've done with, on your left, your new convention exhibition two-level center. And the idea is the triangular area on the upper left is a lot of the support areas, locker rooms, staging, loading areas. And then what you have in blue wrapping it around is a ground-level concourse that relates to the park and relates to the existing amphitheater, which is shown just to the right. The idea on all of this is the building would be loaded in from the north down, and we would be able to fence that in so you don't see the loading function of this building in all scenarios. So as we zoom in, on the one end in the U-shape, you would have the red is a stage setup over the ice. And then you can see the blue going around. And so basically on the inner side of the bowl, what you do is restrooms and concessions, all your services that serve the fans. And the other thing you will notice is in all cases on this, we are linking into your existing concourse of your brand new convention center. And then also we're linking on the north side to all of your service functions that are set back on that area over there and next to your new commissary kitchen that you are building. So basically, this is the second floor plan, and the idea is you'd be able to link to the convention center at ground level, at the concourse level, or at this upper level. And this is where you would have suites, loge suites, and loge club seats. And the reason you do that is that helps the financial feasibility of the building on an annual basis. If you don't sell those kind of things, usually the building is terribly in the red year-round. And if you do sell those things, that's where the money is, as well as all of the other events and tickets that you sell. So again, 4,000 seats, and when we say 4,000, that is the fixed seats that you're seeing in the bowl. The next one we looked at, and there's no drawings for this, is 4,000 puts you at the very minimal size. You heard that worked for the USHL. It really puts you on the low end for concerts, so you start losing a lot of the concerts, the family shows, etc. So we looked at one, and we'll show this later, positives and negatives, but starting with a hockey capacity of 5,000, it would be that same scheme you just saw, with the exception you're adding two or three rows in order to go from the 4,000 seats up to the 5,000 seats. But a lot of similarities, but at 5,000, you start getting to be a more competitive concert building. The other thing I should note, we've done a lot of U-shaped buildings, and hockey teams play in them, but they don't love them because you don't have seats down one end. So the USHL could play in a U-shaped building, but it's not, from a sporting viewpoint, an ideal configuration. So looking at Tim's Toyota. So this then starts to say, what happens instead of a U-shaped building? This was 5,000 seats, but we start doing a 360-degree bowl, which we'll show you in a second. So that option 2B says, okay, the most common size building we've done for communities such as Rochester is 6,000 to 6,500 seats, fixed with a 360 bowl. So we wanted to see how that fit, because we are on a relatively tight site here, and we wanted to make sure it made any sense at all. So what we did is we settled on 6,200 seat capacity. So you get more than 32,000 extra square feet for trade shows that would augment what you're already building. It has a 360 bowl and a much bigger building, so you can attract more family shows, more concerts, etc. And this has been a very typical size that we've done in other communities. So again, when you look at this, what we have here is the 360 bowl, as I said, a portal on the end where Zambonis come on. It could be set up for hockey, figure skating, ice events, basketball, etc. You can either have a center hung scoreboard, or you can do side or end boards. This is one of the key differentials of this type of building. You can see the 360 bowl, but on the one end you have a huge telescopic seating section, which are still individual seats, but it pulls back. So it allows you to pull the stage back, and you get way more seats in front of the stage for concerts. So this type of building gets far more attractive for concerts, and people want to come to the community and set up a slightly wider concourse. When you go bigger, everything starts getting bigger. You have more concessions, more restrooms, wider concourses. These are typical suites beyond, and this is what is a what we call a loge suite in the business. You don't have walls between you, but usually you're selling 4 to 6 seats. You have a front counter, little social area, and a back counter. So it's a more affordable product than a typical suite. And so what we found is if you can mix the three, club seats, loge suites, and regular suites, it's a more viable financial product. So that's this is very similar to the other one, but now you can see on the park, it comes a little further out into the park, but you start to see the 360 bowl and how that relates to the park. So again, as we zoom in, the whole building is a bit bigger, the concourse gets a bit wider, but you still design everything around the 85 by 200. And then in yellow, you can see this big telescopic seating section, and that's what pulls back, and you put the stage back there to get more seats in front of the stage. Then on the upper bowl, you can see the full 360 with more suites, more low suites, and more club seats. So this one, we thought, you know, basically you could open up the building, an indoor-outdoor relationship to the park, so there would be a lot of glass on the park, unlike the current building, which kind of turns its back to the park. So the thought is you could do that very simply. The other thing is, as we investigated, is does it make any sense to add an indoor-outdoor amphitheater? That was a question, because in the arena business, the slowest season is the summer season, and a lot of the concerts are set up to just tour outside, and they don't necessarily want to come inside to an arena. So the idea was to take this scheme, put an exterior amphitheater on the outside, which you can see diagonally to the lower right, and you would have a large door that would open, and then what we would do is we would put a stage on that end. So this was a very quick rendering of how we did it, kind of at the intersection of the bend and the river with your building over here on the left, looking across the bridge, of a lot of glassiness that can look out to the park and relate the building inside to outside, but it all fits around the art center as well. So then what we did is we started saying, how do we look at the cost? So the things that affect cost in these kind of buildings are obviously the number of seats, because that generates a lot of the square footage. What your the ground level concourse is creating more seats per square foot. And then the volume. So the number of concourses, we have a single concourse at an upper level. Premium amenities, you still have a lot of premium amenities in this building. All of these are very multi-purpose. This is not a hockey alone arena. That would be a much less expensive building, but you would get far less events downtown. Obviously, if we went to the amphitheater and had a large openable glass, that is a feature that costs more, as well as the amphitheater itself of not doing it. And then again, we looked at a lot of different options of 45 degrees, all of which we showed you today, and we had 3 or 4 other versions where we just put it orthogonally to the building and it didn't fit on the site as well. So the other thing we have seen, we're working on the Target Center, Rob's working on the Vikings. Minnesota has very accelerating construction costs as we speak. So that's one thing, and Rochester is not an inexpensive place to build.
So Don, why don't we, before we dive into budget, let's stay here. That's a lot to digest with all the design concepts. So maybe before we launch into talking about cost and schedule and, you know, sort of next steps, should we go back and answer any questions on those three basic options?
Anyone from the council?
Now, this isn't, I guess, germane to the main part of the project, but you'd shown in the load-in area, kind of to the top right, and it's on the same concourse level. One of the challenges with the new Civic Center configuration is loading in shows for Presentation Hall. Would that have connectivity? Would you be able to use?
Yes.
Might be.
So there's about, let's go back one more, I think. Yeah. So the idea is that a lot of this area is the service functions. This is the new commissary kitchen we're building. So what we're doing is going beyond the loading dock and coming in. So we are using the commissary kitchen, and we've just assumed that was a given to work around this. So the idea is a lot of the support down below is in this area, and a lot of the support, it links into the back of house, all of this. So all of the access that you have with this diagonal coming through all remain. And then the idea is we would have the really big loading staging here and three trucks. So when you do an arena like this, you have to make sure you have dock high trucks that can load in, like for conventions or for concerts. But you also want to be able to drive a truck on the floor when you're doing big tire events, motocross, any rodeos. They have a lot of dirt on the floor. So you have to have a truck come drive right in here. So that's all of this. We're not showing the fence here, but the idea is this would be fenced off so you don't see this big loading function from the river and across the river, and it would all be hidden. But all of this will be able to work together and maintain the existing loading that is there, but there'd be a lot more back and forth relationship between them than it's currently exists, with a much more flexible building than we currently have.
The flexibility is key for attracting these touring events, and if the building is flexible as this one would be, it has a reputation for being easy to get in and out of, that is one of the best selling points to get, you know, as long as you have a good market, which you have, to have a building that is easy to get in and out of for these various acts, it's a very important aspect of this.
And then what you have is, even though I said it's a really tall two-story building, the first floor is about two stories itself, the concourse you saw on those, with a suite level above, but it's 50 feet from the ice level to the bottom of the truss, which is really important for not only sporting events, but for all the concerts. And you have rigging going from one end to the other, so you can do big center concerts, big end concerts, 150,000 pounds, lots of power, lots of rigging, none of which your building really has all of those things now. So it starts to limit it, as well as the current seating bowl, which is very unusual in the business.
All right. Anyone else at this point? I'm sure we'll have more questions as we go.
Sure. All right. So, yeah, Don did a good job of talking about, you know, what are some of the drivers of cost, but also feasibility. They kind of go hand in hand. So what we're trying to do here is find the right balance of investment and return for you. To find that building that's the right size that will serve you well for the next 30 years and won't be obsolete in 10 years after you make the major investment. But it will act as a true multi-purpose venue that's going to attract all kinds of events for many years to come. So as we started to try to develop some cost modeling for this, we looked at a number of sources and our experience, and we reached out to Knutson here in town to talk about local costs. And the information you're going to see is generally the way we generally do budgets for these projects is to divided into five basic categories. Site costs, which are fairly similar among all the options. You have a It's a fairly difficult site here. The soils are not great. You're going to be on some kind of deep pile foundation system. it's a rather tight site. Access is a little restricted, but all of those things can be dealt with. But as you compare across alternatives, the site costs are generally similar for the options that we've shown. The construction costs, are going to vary by the building square footage, building volume, how tall it is, number of seats, other amenities in it. And a little bit of variability in the costs based on the size and program. The next category, major category of costs, is FF&E, furniture, fixtures, and equipment. For a building of this type, it's very important to have lots of movable chairs, portable chairs. This would also include food service equipment. It would include scoreboards, ribbon boards, all sorts of audiovisual equipment, a high-level sound system, all the things that you would tend to expect in a newer building of this size. Development costs, again, would be similar across all the alternatives. That includes permitting costs and design costs and things of that nature. And then we'll talk a little bit about project contingency, but very important in the construction markets today, a lot of volatility. Costs are moving around up and down, mostly up in the markets today, just based on a lot of activity. So it's important to identify in the project budget a significant level of contingency to deal with unforeseen conditions and also changes that crop up along the way. So with all that kind of in mind as background, we looked across a few other projects of a very similar size, including Cedar Park, which Don showed some images of, also Allen, Texas, Missouri, Dodge City, and Bangor, Maine. And what we did is, since all those projects were completed at different times, we normalized those costs and did some adjustment for the regional costs of the building to try to equally weight those, to get a feel for what construction costs on this building type, really very similar building types, all of them, to what we've shown you for option 2B, which is what would be our recommended building here. The construction costs are going to fall in that, $300 to $325 per square foot range if you did that project here today. But that's just construction. So construction costs generally are 60 to 65%, maybe 70% of the overall project budget for all those other reasons that you saw. There's furniture, fixtures, and equipment. There are design costs. There are other costs, site costs, which cause those numbers to be higher than that for a full project budget. So just to give you a feel for that, I put a few slides together here to talk about what things we will be looking out for here if we're able to move forward with this project. Site costs, as I mentioned, it's a challenging site, the deep pile foundations, the tight site. The red line, the site preparation and demolition of the existing facility, those are going to be areas that are going to be challenging until we get further along to know exactly how much those will cost. Construction costs, certainly structure and foundations, structural steel, interior finishes, the seating systems, the retractable systems that for seating up on the stage, and those become expensive. You have to very carefully manage those to get them to conform to a budget, but these are all things that we've done before, and we feel comfortable in the numbers we're going to show you as a target budget for now. But these are components of construction cost in that category. FF&E, just to give you some flavor for what's included in there, the athletic equipment, computers, press equipment facility, food service, graphics, signage, all of those elements are not included in the construction costs, but need to be included in the overall project budget, or else your budget's not big enough. And then development costs like professional fees, testing, permits, legal, taxes, insurance, those costs need to be accounted for as well. And then we talked a little bit about project contingency and the importance of having that. Also, important to note on this set of numbers we're going to show you, financing costs are going to vary from project to project, depending on how the project is financed. Is there a bond financing component? Many different variables. We are not including any financing costs in these cost models. So, because we don't know what they would be, so we've just said, you know, this needs to be studied. We would certainly help you study it, but much more information needs to be obtained before we could figure out what to budget for that. So to kind of get to the punchline, for the 4,000 seat multi-purpose arena, which we feel is really on the small side for this market, you're still looking at about $55 to $60 million on this site. The 5,000 seater, slightly more expensive, and then the 6,000 to 6,200 seat arena is about $65 to $75 million. Is our best educated guess, I guess you could say, based on that design and what we know of this market, without really having a complete design. But those give you some ranges and some targets to understand the magnitude, order of magnitude. You know, as we look at it, I really want to recommend the 6,000 to 6,200 seat arena is, I think, the best investment here. I think that for some incremental investment, you get such a better building, really, and a more flexible building for the future. I think that's a trend that you've seen bearing itself out in many markets across the U.S.
Right, and we looked early at a 8,500 seat one as well, and that just seemed way too big for the market, way more expensive, and when you really saw how many more concerts you got, it wasn't that many, so it just seemed like a tremendous amount of money for very little, very few additional events or capacity. Right.
And what's interesting, too, is when we look at a lot of these throughout the country, this is really kind of the sweet spot for cost and flexibility and size in the market. As soon as you get to those larger buildings that start to creep up to, maybe 8,000 seats, the cost really goes up fairly dramatically. Whereas right around that 6,000 seat, 6,200 seat mark, it's a lot different. It's a much more affordable building, I think we would say. So, we looked at schedule a bit too. We were tasked with looking at what would it take to get a building open for 2017, fall of 2017. And so we've been looking at that, and time marches on. So it's getting tighter and tighter to get to an opening without paying some cost premiums for that opening. But if what this schedule shows is if you were able to start design essentially now, really in the month of November, Don, we've worked on a lot of these buildings together. There are certain economies to moving something ahead like this very quickly through schematic design, maybe in just a month or a month and a half, where normally that would take longer, but we've done enough of these that we think we could accelerate that process. Design development starts, working out more of the details. That's about a two-month process. Getting you directly into construction documents, which is about another 3 months. Now, the trick here is that Don would need to issue some very early bid packages for demolition, for some of the site work, for foundations, and an early steel package that would come out a little sooner than we would normally do on a project like this. So we'd need to lock the design down sort of in a basic configuration, the section, the height, the number of seats, and we could move that along fairly quickly. It would take an effort like that out of the box to get to really get designed done early in the new year and begin to move forward with this. that would get you to a 2017 opening, say October, November of 2017. So that's a lot to digest, I know, but I wanted to give you some feeling of, you know, where you are relative to that type of opening date, which some of you have mentioned. So, you know, if you start later in design, the whole thing is going to shift almost day for day to the right and open later.
So there's not a lot of slack time built in?
Not a lot of slack time anymore, yeah. There's not a lot of slack time. In fact, I would say it's a very tight schedule. I mean, when you look at schedules and you see a lot of these activities that are very vertical, we're trying to put most of the burden on Dawn to do the design very quickly so that we can leave more time for construction. What we find a lot of times is if decisions aren't made, design is forced to go more slowly, then the construction activities start to stack up, and that's when you can run into some problems.
So Mr. Gosley or Mr. Newman, my understanding is that because the type of project this would be, we would require a referendum to issue capital bonds for something like this. Is that correct?
Depends on the funding source you use.
Okay, general obligation bonds.
If it's general obligation bonds, yes, you would need a referendum. There's one other approach, and that would involve other parties involved, in that there is authority for taxes under the DMC legislation, as the DMC board did support this as a public infrastructure project, but that's a whole different thing. So,
I mean,
those are the.
But is there anyone, staff or otherwise, at this table that's advocating for taking away the right of a referendum? I don't think that that's in our purview, but is there anything that we shouldn't have a referendum on something like this?
I think a lot of the council house funds. We haven't heard anything about how they think they're going to fund this.
Okay.
I would love to hear.
So I'm hearing nobody saying that avoid a referendum. So.
I want to hear other options as well.
Okay. Well, let's see how we're paying for it.
That is not part of this presentation, so I'm going to refer to that.
There's a couple things that I think need to be weighed in. Number one, the DMCC needs to have a wing, because you've mentioned that. And they need to have some discussion, as well as the Mayo City Center group itself needs to have some conversation. I would like to see some method of funding, how you plan on doing this. This is a big chunk of money that we're not going to write a check out. So we're going to need to know how it's going to be funded. So I realize that puts your timelines into more of a crunch, but until we see that, I know I can't do anything until I see how this is going to be funded. I don't know where Brad's at. But
I'm back here.
But I think an interest to me would be how is it going to be funded. You talked a lot about public-private partnerships. What's that mean?
Yeah, and just understand that we wanted to understand the feasibility part of this. I didn't want to presume any funding mechanisms at this point. It's not my job to do that. We wanted to listen to you and explore. We have some ideas, but it was never meant to be a 100% public sector project. It's really meant to be a private-public project, and we can take a shot at some funding ideas if you'd like us to. We could show you what other cities have done, what other markets have done. I think we could bring that back for you and engage other groups as well. I think we haven't been able to tell this story, so there's some lines that need to be thrown in the water as well in terms of that. So.
Yeah, we looked at it as sort of the first step is trying to figure out what it is, what it might cost, how it might get done, and then try to figure out what the funding mechanism would be.
I noticed some other individuals here that were a part of this kind of scoping exercise, and maybe they'd want to weigh in with some additional comments or thoughts as we gather our information. Mr. Podine, I see you back there. Care to make any comments?
Excuse me. I on two different things. I guess my big thing is, and I've talked about this a couple times, is what do we want for our city? I mean, people are telling me that the population growth in the next 20 years is just going to skyrocket. So many more jobs, $6 billion for DMC. What do we want for our infrastructure to provide for these families to make it enticing to come to Rochester, Minnesota? I also hear things that we lose concerts, we lose events to La Crosse, to Mankato. And if we could provide a facility, an education or an entertainment facility, along with making it more adaptable for people who want to come here and work and be and go with their family, I think it's a great opportunity for us. And I know I've talked just on the USHL side, too. I know I've worked with that league for over 10 years. I played with Mustang back in the middle 80s, and it's a completely different league now. It's a multi-million dollar business. Professionally ran, some of the top kids in the world are coming to play ice hockey out of it. It would fill our facility with another, I added, I think it was 40 to 44 possible events a year. I think it would drive the dining or the dollars downtown, where you can almost call it the t-shirt night out in the middle of January, where you can park inside, walk inside, go to the game, go eat, go have a drink, go back home. I think it would provide a lot for people who want to come into our community and need. So there are two parts from my side. USHL is just a no-brainer. It would be a great business entity to have in our city. And I know it would work talking to the other owners around the league. I know the league itself is very, very excited to be able to promote and have that product here. I just think for the vision, when I saw that big draw for the show, Rochester, I think it was 2030 or something, 2025, and it just looked like an expanded, huge city. That it needs something like this downtown, I think, to bring kids and families and to entice them to be where we want them in our community. So I think this is a great option. I know it's far from realizing how to pay for it, but I do think it's really worth sitting down and discussing if there is an avenue or a few avenues out there we could provide this, again, for our community.
Brad, would you care to share any comments?
Sure. Just to follow up on Sean's USHL comments, it looks like some of you might have been around when the Rochester Mustang blew around back in the 90s. And
season ticket holder.
I mean, it really is a different league. It's just to give you some statistics, you know, we had, from a player perspective, 37 kids in our league drafted by the NHL, which is more than any other junior league in the world, including the Ontario Hockey League, the Western Hockey League, and the Quebec Hockey League individually. We have two of our coaches are now in the NHL coaching, and a litany of other coaches coaching at NCAA institutions. We have over 120, I believe, NHL players coming from our league playing in the NHL this year. So the growth of hockey in the U.S. Has catapulted this league to be one of the preeminent leagues in the world. And along with that, the ownership groups that have come in, ours being one of them, have raised the level, like you said, of professionalism, not only for the players, but also for the fans. And I'll give you an example. We've rejuvenated the market of Dubuque, Iowa, where they used to have a team much like the Mustangs that played from, I think, 1980 to 2000 in Dubuque. It was a mom-and-pop league with fans, maybe 300 to 500 a game. Dubuque Fighting Saints left in 2000. We brought them back in 2010. We average attendance of about 2,600 a game right now. Our audience is no longer the beer-drinking 25-30-year-old guy who's looking to see a fight. We're predominantly family-oriented in our marketing. Our audience is primarily families, young kids. We've got, you know, large kid zone. We focus on that. And so if I look at what we've done for the community, we've donated over, I think it's $160,000 to various charities within the community, the veterans, cancer nights, things like that. It's effectively major league sports at a minor league level. And that's what our league is doing right now. So if you have any preconceptions of what the USHL is from your time back in the 90s, please wipe that clean, because it's completely different now, and it really is a professional league in, we'll call this a secondary market, due to the population side. I know it's a primary market terms of what you guys are doing here, your business community, and what you're doing with the city. But USHL has thrived in markets of this size, and I believe we've taken an extraordinary amount of risk in our Dubuque entity and some other markets we've been in, but this one we believe would be a very viable market, a very thriving market, a thriving market for the USHL. Okay.
Put you on the spot a little bit, Patrick. Any initial thoughts from a DMC EDA perspective?
Yeah, well, that would be putting me on the spot.
Yeah, and I think if you answered that, you wouldn't be doing your job.
No, Mr. President and members of the council, I just want to comment and just say it was really an excellent presentation, and I think it really helps, I think, illuminate the potential for the community, but I am not in a position necessarily to comment officially from DMC's point of view.
Okay, that's fine.
Thank you.
I see Donna hiding back there, I think.
Sorry.
Any comments from your perspective?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you. I did have the privilege of working with the group through the process. And I think that there are definitely some things that could help us improve our product, especially when it comes to concerts and entertainment events, and even to a degree some of the sporting events that we do. Our current arena, the capacity has diminished primarily because of the stage size and the configuration of the building. The fan-shaped building, you obscure a lot of the seats that are on the sides, and the more equipment they stack or they even fly, you create obstructive views. So right now we're looking at most reserve seating concerts being around 4,500. When we first started with this back in 1986, we were at least 1,000 more than that, just because the stages were smaller and they didn't have the production demands that are there. We do face a lot of competition when it comes in the entertainment world. We do a fair amount of events now, but we would have the opportunity to increase our options if we could go up a little bit in capacity. The only precursor there, we still have competition, and we do have a university here, but we don't have a university like La Crosse and Mankato. And those, as you know, any of you who have college students know, those kids have more money than you and I will ever have. and they spend it pretty freely. We also are still challenged greatly by the restrictions that come when a concert books at a casino and they cannot book within a 100-mile radius. We call that a radius clause. And with Mystic Lake and Treasure Island nearby, that has affected us. And I think I pointed out to several groups, we were real close on a Sarah McLaughlin gate this year, and we lost it to Mystic Lake. And that's because they pay top rate, and promoters who use our building can't do that. They can't. So we do have some challenges there, and they will continue to exist because no matter what we do, we're still going to be 70 miles south of some of the finest performing arts centers in the Midwest, and there is nothing we can do about that. So we carve out a niche for ourselves and recognize that we are challenged, but we have done very well. The building needs work. We never had a rigging system, and every single production company that comes into the arena, I don't want to tell you what kind of language they use when they look up at that ceiling, but it's not G-rated. And so we have been challenged with that from the get-go. We need a rigging system. We can't do Broadway because it limits us. So there are other things that we could do that we can't do now. Ice shields. Right now you have to bring in a portable tank, we'll call it, but the caliber just isn't there. So, there are definitely some pluses for us. Believe it or not, Taylor Arena is 29, just turned 29 years old. So we'd like to see the upgrade, but we also know that more than anything, finances.
Thank you. Let me bring it back to the council now for questions, comments for any of our presenters, guests, or any ideas for immediate next steps? Mr. Wojak.
Well, let's take the starting in November and throw that away, because that ain't happening anytime soon. What I do want to say, though, is the one thing that I'm particularly concerned about, and if there's funding mechanisms that don't require City of Rochester bonding, I'm okay with, proceeding with caution at that point if that's what we decide to do. If, however, we're using general revenue bonds to pay for this, the public has a right to a referendum on those. And I would like to explicitly direct staff at this table today that they are not to take any actions that would supersede the public's right to that referendum. And I specifically bring this up because other cities have done this. I have some concerns, but that's one of the things that was made pretty clear to me by some of my constituents is that they want to maintain their right to oversee this.
And I have no problem with that, but if we ask Mr. Jones to go and work with his group, and that's outside our purview, and they come back with some funding mechanisms,
yep.
And I imagine they would have some conversations with Mr. Newman and Mr. Quenville, that's fine.
Yep.
That's all I'm asking is to show me how do you pay for it. I think that's fair. I think there's some creativity out there. They say they have it. Well, let's see it. Let's see them put it to work. No one's denying the fact that if we decide to do this and we want to use geo bonds, that the public should have a say. They should. And no one's ever said that they shouldn't. But I want to make sure that we give them an opportunity to go out and find out what kind of funding they can procure. And when they're talking about public-private partnerships, let's see what that is. And I don't want to put any clamps on them at this point and stop them from expressing themselves and thinking out of the box.
So what you're saying and what I'm saying are on the same page, mm-hmm. because so you're okay with directing staff as well to make sure we maintain that referendum for the GEO.
I don't believe that they would do the government bonds without coming back and talking to us about GEO bonds.
Straight up GEO bonds, you'd need to have a referendum.
Right.
Required.
So
unless you got state authorization to bypass that process.
Well, we wouldn't have that until the legislator met anyhow, and I doubt that we would get that. So that's January.
I'm of the opinion that property taxes is not a funding source for this anyway.
I would agree. The other thing that I wanted to point out, too, is that, I always point out the difference between needs and wants. And our community has some unmet needs right now. And this is something that we want. And among those unmet needs are just paying for the existing street maintenance that we have in place, the staffing. We've seen where that list is at. Certainly transit. The library is significantly over capacity, and that's one of the core responsibilities of our government. And then beyond that, we have some challenges just in terms of broadband, and we need to factor all of these things in when we're figuring out. So any funding source that can be used for this on the public side can, of course, in theory, be used for any of these priorities or to shift things into these priorities. So ultimately, if we do something like this, we need to figure out how we're addressing these other needs as well.
And I do think that this project should be taken back to the DMCC. Let that group take a look at it, see what their thoughts are. I mean, they're a big part, as well as the MCC committee. I've mentioned them before, and I'll mention them again. I think those two groups have huge parts to play in this, and they should also see this presentation or see whatever they have left so that they can come back and make comment as well.
And one of the questions I have, too, and there's probably some figures that they can get us fairly quickly, is I do want to know how much parkland we're losing in the different options as well. I've always taken a position that I don't want to ever see a net loss of green space in the downtown, and I'm sticking with that, so I at least want to quantify how much green space we're losing in these options.
And they may wish to speak with Mr. Schmidt as well, since that he utilizes that park very much in the summer. There would definitely be an impact on the civic music down by the Riverside Concert if something of this nature would go ahead. So I would hope that they would talk with the Arts Center, civic music, and these groups as well to get some input. Mr. Quenville.
I think when you arrive at your decision, some other information you need is, what is the amount of money the private sector is putting in it? Mm-hmm. What sort of control are they going to expect for that money? What's the cash flow mm-hmm. that's coming in off of the advance? How much cash flow goes to the private sector interest for their mm-hmm. for their investment? What is the operating cost of the particular facility? It'd be interesting to know what some of the operating experience has been in some of these other cities where this the UHS how operates, yeah, and how they're operating their arena, what the operating results are from that arena.
And one of the great things about the freedom we have as a community is a lot of communities now use community benefit agreements, so we're not just hoping for the best, we're going to create some jobs. We can actually put a community benefits agreement in place, which will ensure those jobs that we're creating or that are in this facility are living wage jobs, not more poverty jobs that are going to cause us to build more housing and need more transit. So we have that ability to certainly tie that into the contract, right, Mr. Quinbold? We can have that option.
I would assume you would.
Yeah.
Which is what we've done with other construction projects. That's right in
line
with...
We've never done a community benefits agreement.
Right.
But, a lot of cities are, and for good reasons. I mean, these are huge public subsidies typically go into these, and, we don't want to create poverty out of it.
Well, clearly, we're going to need some additional information, particularly that financial analysis, the operational strategy, et cetera, et cetera. So clearly that's not going to all happen in the next few weeks. So it's going to take a little bit of time. Mr. Nygberg?
Maybe two questions. One is, obviously Michael raised the issue of the park lines back there that they're pushing. Mm-hmm. Do you want the park board to weigh in at some point in the near future, or do you want to wait until they come back with some financing? The second question I've got is, did they look at other sites besides just the park line? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyone want to answer?
We were not asked for other sites.
Before we engaged the feasibility study, we toured a lot of different groups around. We looked at Graham and Rack and some vacant land, and it was very apparent very quickly that what we were trying to create was something to benefit downtown and the downtown district. And so we really honed in on Taylor Arena. It's tough to do a feasibility study with everything, and so when you look at what we're trying to create is connected. We already have parking. We already have a lot of the ancillary businesses that people frequent before and after these types of things. So, that's why we honed in on Taylor Arena. And because of the aging infrastructure, we have an opportunity to address that as well. So to answer your question, preliminarily, yes, we toured groups, USHL and others around, showed them the community, became very interested, but extremely interested in the downtown corridor.
So.
A little bit more about funding sources. Unfortunately, the local option sales tax is kind of tied up for a number of years because that would be some of the logical funding source. You'd always go back to the legislature and ask for another 0.25%.
No.
No.
So that is an option. There's that food and beverage tax that's in associated with the DMC legislation. Theoretically, it'd have to be viewed as a DMC project to institute a food and beverage tax, but that would raise a number of millions of dollars to help finance it.
I would be concerned about putting a new tax in place for this without having the public weigh into it. And part of that concern, too, is that I was approached by some people that said if the food and beverage tax is ever used for something, for God's sake, let's use it for affordable housing for people in the food and beverage industry. And I think that made a lot of sense to me. And I certainly think that the public should weigh in if we put a tax like that in place, and we should have some discussion of what the best use for that tax would be.
Well, if you're going to get 55 to 75 million bucks, you're going to have to do something like that.
You're
not going to cut that money otherwise.
And that's the thing. I mean, even, 75 million private parties maybe come up with half of it or something like that, which is fantastic. That's still, we need 2.8 million per year based on a 4% interest rate bonded over 20 years, just, off the top of my head going with that. The issue is going to be that USHL is fantastic. I've seen the league is wonderful. I've seen it in a number of cities. The product is great, but what's going to come down to is that the best use of $32.5 million in this community? And our downtown is pretty darn vibrant right now. It's really picking up, and there's a lot of interest and a lot of development going on, a lot of development interest. And so I think we need to quantify what those gains really are going to be for the community.
If you're serious about pursuing something like this, you have to look at that food and beverage tax in my estimation.
Well, I'd like to give the group a chance to go back and come think outside the box and come back and show us what's there. I mean, we can sit here and discuss the types of taxes, things, but they haven't even looked at it.
I understand
come back,
that.
So I think we ought to give them that.
But then you have some, you have to have some realization of just how much you're willing to do with this thing. So, I mean, obviously, how long is it going to take for you to make some decision if it moves on to the next step?
Well, I think
because obviously, I mean, you aren't going to make November. You may not even make 2016.
But I do think that we should give them that opportunity. They said they're willing to take that on. Let's see what they come back.
So my big fear with a project like this isn't the initial packaging and marketing effort that gets done, and on paper everything will look great. I think there was some talk about other examples that have happened, and I just did a cursory search and found the Santa Ana Star Center, which is in Rio Rancho, New Mexico, excuse me, thank you. And it was a $47 million, and it wasn't USHL, it was another hockey league. But essentially, the city ended up on the hook for $3.7 million every year for the center once the anchor tenant proved unviable. And I look at that, and as a, you know, as a steward of the city, I'm not responsible for adopting the bright, you know, the bright picture. I'm responsible for managing the worst case scenario here. And the worst case scenario for some of these really big arena projects is we're on the hook not just for the initial building costs, we're on the hook for the maintenance and operation when or if anchor tenants don't work out. And, you know, I'm really concerned, and frankly, I'm not sure that I'm heard much today that makes me excited about spending more staff time on this. To me, I'm kind of in the camp of why now? You know, we have a lot of capital needs coming up. Does it make more sense to revisit this? The league is vibrant now. I hope the league is vibrant when I feel that this is a little bit more viable, but most of our, you know, funding mechanisms are tied up for years. And, you know, I think there's some examples here of these not working out for the community that they're put in. I'm very tentative on this one.
So, I mean, I was under the impression we haven't devoted much staff time to this. Is that how much staff
not
time?
Yet.
Okay.
Well, it certainly has a pretty decent proposal for having not much staff time. But
well, these gentlemen did all the work mostly through with Brad, so we haven't, Gary and I haven't done much on it yet. But I, you know, I'd like to know just how much we do, and some of the questions I raised, who's going to answer them? Is Brad and those people going to come back with some financing mechanism? But what about then? What is the investment that's being brought by the outside, and what sort of control do they have for that investment? What sort of cash flow do they get off the? What for a percentage of the cash flow do they get off of the operation? And what's the overall general estimated operating cost and revenues of that structure? What is some of the, you know, more of the relationship or experience in some of those other cities? Who is to do that? Are we to do that? Or is Convention Bureau to do that? Or?
We'll answer that question. Mr. Ruskin.
I'd like to thank Brad, Sean, and all of Brad Jones, all the people that have had interest in giving this for the USHL to come and identify Rochester as the city and the state of Minnesota, the state of hockey that they want to be in, I think is something we should be proud of. And so I think there is a little justification to looking at this a little bit deeper. But, you know, one of the things that I think what we're trying to do here is we need to just assess an opportunity. In my world of amateur sports, the buzz has been for the last few years, private-public partnerships are what get things done and are an effective way to do it. But you have to have people that are willing to step up, put skin in the game, and commit to their part of the private-public partnership. And I think that, from what I'm hearing from the people that are interested in this, it seems like they're very serious about this. They're bringing an opportunity that I've never seen in all the years that I've been in Rochester. I can go back to the Mustangs when they used to play in the 60s, which is sad to date myself to that, but when they played in the Male Civic Auditorium and they shoveled the ice, and I think back then it was the Green Bay Bobcats, not the Green Bay Gamblers, and the Waterloo. You know, those teams are still in the league, and Rochester was in it then. I was so excited when I was a little kid to go to those games. It was in the little Male Civic Auditorium. It was a good memory, and so I think that that's kind of a neat deal. One of the things that we have is I don't know, Stephen, do we have any capital improvement projects or any plans for the Civic Arena to do anything with it in the next 20 years?
No, and I do realize that we need to do something with it. So,
so you know, we're on the hook for I've seen in a couple slides the word obsolete there. So, you know, if it isn't now, it will be in the near future. And you know, this is, again, an opportunity to look at what could we do with the public-private partnership. So, and then one of the things that I caught on the slide here, very high household income. I know in the DMC report or board meetings we've had, one of the things that they identified is we have a very high household income. We have a lot of leakage in the city. A lot of the dollars are leaving the city and going to other places for their entertainment value, entertainment dollars. So I guess I would wonder what it would hurt to send it to the DMC or an EDA for their feedback on it, just to see what they think, how it fits into the plan and what the interest is there. You know, again, this isn't about pulling a fast one. This is about assessing an opportunity. And if we, you know, a little bit of staff time to do something that could benefit our downtown and our infrastructure in the downtown seems to make some sense. So I'll leave it at that.
Mr. Bilderman. I think we've heard a lot of questions. I hope they've heard the questions, and that way when they choose to come back, they can come back with answers. My feeling on how much staff time we should put in this, not a lot. If they come back and ask for some financing options and things, so be it. But I don't think we want to spend the time in coming up with this. This sounds like something they're willing to do, and it sounds like it's something they have done. They've heard the questions. I think the questions are fair from all the parties that have asked questions. Let them go answer them. And then when would we expect to see you back?
I think we'd have to get back to you on specifics, but let us talk about it, and we'll get back to you with an answer.
Yeah, and I do believe the DMC ought to have an opportunity as well as the MCC group.
Could you do that presentation to the DMC board? Is that a possibility, so they can see?
Yeah, sure, of course. You know, what I'd also like to say, just there are of every type of project, every type of initiative, there are bad examples and there are good examples. So I think that it would be helpful to provide, you know, some examples that both good and bad, and why they were good or bad, because there's a way to do these projects in our experience that makes them very successful, and there's a way not to do them that makes them very unsuccessful. And the one that you identified there in New Mexico was pretty poor execution and a lot of factors that do not line. It's sort of an apples and oranges sort of situation with Rochester.
Basically a building in the middle of nowhere. We did it. So it's on a far, far, far site that they decided to make a city center. It would be like you moving Rochester City out 20 miles in a field and then saying that's our city center. Mm-hmm. It was a bad site.
The downtown sites are very good because you capture a lot of that economic activity that you generate, and you just, you know, you hold it downtown and you create an energy and activity downtown that you don't get on one of those remote sites, it's fair to say.
So, did I see somewhere in here where we had the economic impact?
Typically when you do an economic and fiscal impact study, that's generally a whole separate study. That'll take, you know, on a life of its own. You really need to have kind of the design nailed down, an option chosen.
Location.
We have a lot of the baseline market data complete. Then you need to run, you know, a pro forma for what kind of activity happens inside the arena, outside the arena. And it's really a different level of study, sort of one that would come potentially next.
Nick, we have an economic impact calculator that we use, and really what we needed from them is the attendance and how that varies from the current structure. So we can extrapolate that on that. And that data is very specific to Rochester. So we can take a shot at that. We just need, which we have, the projected attendance, the number of events, and we have a calculator that we use to get to that number. So.
Ms. Means, and then Mr. Camping had his hand up, and then we'll try to bring this one to closure for today.
Well, I want to thank you for this discussion, this presentation. Brad, I want to thank you for taking the time to meet with me and help me through some of the complexities of this. What I see is that this, well, first of all, I want to say that I felt it very important that the Arts Center the Mr. Thompson and Mr. Schmidt from our music center and Mr. Stavel from the Civic Theater be involved in some way and be pulled in, because it will affect them one way or another. And it would, since they're our own buildings, I believe they should have a strong voice. Their voice should certainly be heard. On the other hand, and then of course the DMC and the EDA, maybe there's some money available there. I'm not sure. I'm going to leave the money part alone. What I will say is, when I was most impressed by the many flexible uses that are proposed for this. I mean, from hockey, I couldn't imagine a football field. I think I kept saying that. Is there a football field in there too? Yes. There are some opportunities to expand our tax base. It's an opportunity also for some of the people that go out of town to stay here if we have an amenities here that are comparable to what they have seen in other larger, smaller cities. I think it complements our whole artistic endeavors here in the city as well. And, you know, at some point we do have to be very visionary about where we want to go and how we're going to raise money rather than through the tax levy or in addition to the tax levy. So I thank you for your thinking far ahead. I just wanted to be as inclusive as you can get it and make sure that our own folks that are in our buildings now are involved in the conversation and have some input.
I said it at the PV Dialogues, but I think it bears reiterating that I don't remember if it was a week or 2 weeks ago that we sat around this table and we talked about the needs of transit, the affordability of living in Rochester, and I feel like it feels like we're in a little bit of a parallel universe now where we're talking about putting up a hockey arena. And I hate to admit it, but I kind of believe that these hockey arenas are a little bit of a luxury. I don't really want, you know, it reminds me of a line from Jurassic Park. You know, they're so focused on could we never stop to ask should we. And I think a little bit of sending this on to DMC is maybe sending the wrong message about what DMC should be. I get this feedback constantly that DMC should be about the community, should be about what it gets and what we can do for the community by becoming a destination for medical care. And I don't see the connection. And I hate to be the stick in the mud, but if I'm the one that doesn't agree with it, so be it. It'll feel like I run my conscience right at it. And we can move on.
Well, may I make a comment, you know, many of our patients that come here and they've come with extended family and they stay for a long period of time, and oftentimes they'll say there's just not enough to do. And I think those boxes or, you know, those special spaces that people can contract to buy so they can go to the games, I think most of it will be at a rate, hopefully, that our visitors and the people that live here can also afford to go. To the games if they're interested in going to the games or seeing what I've forgotten what some of the other uses are for this, but it's multiple use. It's quite visionary. It's not impossible, but I think it will be impossible if we do not connect with the folks that are going to be directly affected by it.
All right. Mr. Wojcik, then Mr. Bildebeck, one of the things I'd like to end up with is kind of a straw poll here. Because I think the big missing pieces are the financial effect analysis, and financing options. So we need kind of a straw poll whether we want the group to continue and bring back some additional information, or what do you want to do?
And that was one of the items that I was going to touch on was the financial analysis. And I've never believed the line that stadiums are money makers for communities. They're an amenity. They're something that you have in your community that people can enjoy. But they're not a profit center for communities. I've never accepted that. I just read an article about the worst professional sports stadiums deals in American history, and our Viking Stadium up north made the list near the top of it. No surprise there. We need independent analysis. We don't need the folks that have been working on this to do this. We need independent financial analysis if we go forward, showing what the true costs and benefits are. Just as you, Mr. Staver, suggested with the broadband, it's important that we bring independent people to look in, and I'd say that it was appropriate there, and it'll be appropriate here as well. I do think that Taylor Arena is functionally obsolete. In fact, Taylor Arena, it's in its 29th year of being functionally obsolete. It was designed wrong from the start, and so anything we do want to be careful to do right. And this community has invested a ton in sports stadiums. Since I've moved here, it's twice in the volleyball center, the regional sports stadium, the bubble, and now finishing that off, the recreation center, along with a lot of sports fields. You know, there are a lot of people in the performing arts community. There are a lot of people associated with the library that say, hey, we've got some unmet needs in the community too, and we can bring a lot to downtown. So we need to look at all of our options and figure out what the best use is for the dollars. And I still say streets and staff are right at the top of that list, and we're not taking care of that quite yet either.
I think it's important. We've done it before, and I've supported before, looking at different options and bringing options back to us. When you come and you say, this is a sports stadium, and that's it, I think that's you're only hearing half of what was presented today. And we can sit and debate whether this brings money into Rochester or it brings money into businesses that are in Rochester that hire people to take care of that. I think the big thing is, though, as I take away, is it doesn't hurt us to look. We're spending very little staff time, and you're looking at a huge amenity that could be a part of Rochester, and you could fill up and replace what Mr. Wojak just referred to as an obsolete facility since it was built. Bon Jovi was one of the first groups there, and I remember that. And in fact, we made the video of that tour. But I think it's important for all of us to remember that when we have opportunities to hear additional information, that allows us to make the good choices, whether it's here, whether it's talking about roads, whether it's talking about housing, or other things. I've always supported getting information. This extra information is not costing us anything, or very little, and it is going to give us an opportunity to see, is this something that could work in Rochester or not work in Rochester? We have not signed any deal. We have not said, yes, let's go get a shovel and break ground. We haven't done any of that. But we do owe the public the opportunity and the right for us to hear as much information before we make these decisions as possible. And that's all we're asking for. And it's important to ask the questions. But again, remember, all we're doing is getting information. We haven't committed. Mr. Hickey?
Yeah, so if you're looking for direction, so I'd like to see more on the financials. I think Rabal said that in agreement. I'd like to hear what the DMC has to say. So those are the two pieces I'd like to see.
Anybody disagree with that direction?
Nope.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to beat a dead horse. I think there's other projects, there's other things we should be investing the staff time in. So that's my perspective on it.
I'd like the MCC committee and the theater art center as well. Okay. Pacific music.
Yeah.
I don't think we should kill it right now. I think
we should. You should listen.
I do too. Sounds like
there's a lot of information given. Okay. And obviously we're wanting to invest very little staff time in terms of sort of the resource.
Who, so I should work with Brad to get some stuff
so
more
that was my next question. Who, I understand what Mr. Wojak said about, you know, pull maybe an independent resource.
Given that's later.
Huh?
Yeah. I think that's later.
Right.
I think we need to hear it first.
Now, initially, I think this group knows enough to at least bring back some information. We're kind of doing a litmus test at this point on the project.
Okay. I'll work with Brad to get some more information back to you, along with whatever the consultants may do.
You'll have to tell us the timetable, you know, how quickly you'd want to come back. I do agree with what Mr. Campion said. I'm not insensitive to some of our other capital needs, whether it's the more routine street maintenance and so forth. We've got some other capital projects we are aware of, whether it be a library expansion or a police precinct. So I do think we need to be sensitive to the priority. So we should consider any project in isolation.
That is a question, though, that has come up, is like how are we setting priority here? Because, you know, even time consideration at this table is a limited asset. You know, we have to be a little bit cognizant of. So I think that's a one maybe for us to bite off for next year. You know, we took the fewest steps this year to get a schedule out, but I think next year, one of the big items is going to be prioritizing things that come forward so that we're not spinning our wheels maybe on things that are down the list from things we set as a city's priority.
And I think on top of that, a process is a challenge. We get people coming from every direction trying to figure out, you know, how to get something done in the city, and sometimes they don't think they know where to turn. So I think that's one of the things we've identified as a challenge.
Okay. All right. So, call down close for today, at least. We have one more topic, equally as exciting. Consideration of a proposed stormwater rate increase.
Whoa, where's everyone going? You heard that.
How much
for you? USHO.
Oh, we got plenty.
Did you try out or?
You know, the USHL, they're different now. They pay their bills. That was what the Mustangs were famous for.
All right.
You guys talk about.
Let's get on with this last item after 5 o'clock hour.
See, I've got a 5:30 in the same room, so.
Okay, let's let our guests continue. Go ahead.
This isn't nearly as exciting.
Thank you, everybody.
We're going to do our best to capture your imagination. I'm Nick Dragicich with Springstead. My associate, Patty Kettles. We initially did a stormwater financing alternative study a year or so ago and then updated it for this presentation. So maybe we could start on page 2 because the first ones are just pretty pictures and don't really tell you a whole lot. The purpose was to look at financing alternatives for your stormwater utility based on the CIP and the capital items that you're going to be forced to undertake as a result of your new MS4 permit. And we prepared 5 different scenarios for you to look at, understanding that whenever you're considering looking at rates, it's never a pleasant thing, but sometimes it's a necessary thing. So on page 3, you have your Stormwater Management Plan Area Charge, or SWIM PAC, as it's commonly referred to, which was introduced in 1998, and that's for your new stormwater ponds. There's a fee per acre for residential and a fee per acre for commercial businesses that pay for the construction of those ponds. On page 4, you have your stormwater utility fee, which staff refers to as SWUF, and you also introduced that in 2004, and that's charged to your existing residents and commercial accounts to pay for the operation of the stormwater system. As you know, monthly charge started at $2.50 in 2010, has been at $3 since 2011 for the fixed customer charge, and the user charges $13.54 an acre, which is passed on to the various properties in the city. On slide 5, it shows some historical information about the stormwater utility itself, showing the flow of revenues each year and expenses and the operating income. And you can see the revenues trended down somewhat the last couple of years. Expenses have trended up, and the operating income has gone down. Nothing probably that you don't already know, but we need to look at that so we get some sense of what's been happening. On slide 6 is the information about the amount of money in the fund, cash and investments. You can see that the cash itself has gone down from 14 to 15 budget, and the investments have gone down slightly as well. So you started building some cash up, and it's starting to tail off now or come down. So on page 7, what did we use for assumptions as we did this study? Because every study has to have some assumptions. We assume no growth in the projected customer base. You probably have some limited growth, but the amount of growth historically for the last 4 years has been about 1%. If we had assumed some growth in customer base, we've had increased revenue, operating expenditures, for the utility, and so they're somewhat offsetting. We trended the other revenues and expenditures based on historical trends over the last 4 years, or 5 years, and then the capital outlay required by the MS4 permit was funded in all the scenarios we made, because you have no choice but to fund them under your permit requirements, or you would be fined. Those MS4 permit requirements on page 8 were estimated to be about $530,000 in 2015 and to grow 3% each year. So you have a fairly big piece of investment you're going to incur that you haven't been incurring historically. On page 9 is the current stormwater capital improvement program. I'm showing what would be spent each year and the projected source of those funds. But again, I'll remind you, don't include the MS4 permit requirements. This is just capital improvements, about $20 million over this planning period. So we broke those down a little further on sheet 10 to show which of those were required just for maintenance of the existing system. So you have assets out there that are wearing out that need to be renewed and replaced, and those are the dollar value of those in the green colored bars, and in the blue colored bars are the new projects that you will be undertaking.
It's about 80% maintenance, 20% new.
So on page 11, talk about the scenarios. In the first scenario, we said, well, what happens if we just try and fund everything at current rates? What happens to the cash in the fund? What does it look like? Scenario two, we said, what amount of CIP could we fund at current rates using only retained earnings? So we would spend down the cash, basically, in the fund, and how much could we fund under that scenario? Scenario three was, well, what if we raised our fees 3% each year? How much capital could we fund? Scenario four was a projection of the rate increases needed to fund only the maintenance items in the CIP. We forgot about any new capital. And scenario five was what it would take to fund everything. So on sheet 13 shows what happens if we try and fund with no rate increases. And you can see that we have this minimum cash and investments that we were recommending in the context of our study on the red line with the dollar banks. That's based on having 3 months of operating money in place at the end of each fiscal year. If you had any debt that was issued, we'd include 12 months of interest and principal if there isn't any at this point in time. And then a 2% of your of your assets for reserve in the stormwater. And we recommend that because stormwater utilities are notorious for having catastrophic events, huge rainfalls that cause some damage, and you should have some cash to replace those. You can see under this scenario, you run out of money in 2018. So it's not possible to manage the stormwater utility and do the capital improvements that you need without raising rates. And I'll stop there in case there's any questions.
Okay. I don't think anybody is shocked.
Okay. Good.
I know we're pausing for a moment. If you could just roll back to slide 7. Explain to me again why our kind of the underlying assumption on this, all the scenarios was no growth in projected customer base.
When we look back at the census data, you had about 1% growth between each year from 2010 to 2014, and that was fairly minimal. If we assumed some growth in there, we would have assumed some increase in operating expenditures as well as a result of that growth, because you'd have more land that would be developed and you take on more area. So we thought historically that wasn't such a significant item that it would impact the outcome of the study.
I don't know. It's talk about DMC. When we're supposedly on the verge of a large growth spurt, it just seems like maybe a faulty underlying assumption. But
and we could have built in, if we'd have built in, let's say a 3% growth every year, we would have probably built in some percent and a half growth in expenditures as well. So you're not going to grow your way out of it, was what we concluded.
Okay. All right, thank you.
So on slide 14, this is scenario two. What could we fund at our current rates? We know we can't fund everything, but what could we fund? And the green bars represent the amount of CIP that could be funded, and the multicolored bars show what would not be funded. So there's a significant amount of the CIP that cannot be funded at current rates, although some could be.
So this is saying nothing about a categorization of unfunded SIP liabilities. It's just that it would be unfunded. Mm-hmm.
Just would be unfunded. Yep.
It's about $10.7 million is funded of the 20, so about 46% that wouldn't be funded in that scenario.
In scenario three, we look at what could be funded with a 3% annual increase. And you see we can fund a little bit more of that, but it's still a lot of significant projects that would go unfunded. Remembering our large portions are maintenance projects. So on slide 16, under scenario 4, it's 6.5%. We're getting better, but we look in 2019, we have some pretty good-sized bars that would be unfunded.
And scenario 4 is the green ones now are all the maintenance items. So you're funding all the maintenance items, and then the multicolored on top there are the new projects that aren't being funded.
So under scenario 5, we said, well, let's look dangerously and find out what would we need to raise rates to fund both maintenance and new CIP items. That was 10.75% annual increases. Would do that for you. I would not give you your recommended level of reserves, but it would allow you to fund all of the CIP and maintenance items. To get to a recommended level of reserves and fund everything would take 12.5% annual rate increases to get that done. What does that mean, to the different charges that you have on slide 18? The customer charge at each one of those increases is shown at $3 currently. Under the largest scenario showing the 10.75, it would go to $5 by 2020. And the SWF charge would go from $13.54 an acre to $22.56 an acre under the 10.75 scenario. You can see what they'd be in the other ones, but there would be increases that would affect people's bills. Mm-hmm. Which we show on slide 19, the impact on the average monthly bill. Again, looking, and I'm picking the 10.75 because that's the worst case at this point. On the 10.75, the average residential monthly bill would go from $6.18 to $10.30, or a little over $4 a month. And the non-residential monthly average would go from $104.74, or about $41.88 a month. Those would be the impacts of funding stormwater. Maybe we'll take a catch your breath thing there in case anyone has any questions.
Continue.
Okay. The other piece we were looking at, because some of the growth related items are potentially paid for with your stormwater area charge. How did you compare to other cities with high growth rates? This was actually from 2014 we initially did this study. And if you look at them, Woodbury has a fairly complex formula running anywhere from $11,000 to $37,000 an acre depending on the type of development. The other ones you can read for yourself, but Rochester was the lowest at $3,383 an acre. On the commercial side, Shakopee had the highest at a little over $14,000 an acre, and Rochester was the lowest again of these cities at about $5,189 an acre. So there may be some opportunity if you look at the charge for the new facilities to have some reduction on rates to pay for those if you chose to go that route and not put yourself and a discompetitive advantage relative to these other communities.
The city of Blaine is also one of these larger growing communities, fast growing communities, and they pass the costs on to the developer, all of them, so that's why they're not in these charts.
Good strategy. So within the stormwater chart, there's a swim pack capsule, which is we're building these regional ponds and other systems for new growth and development. And so how are we paying for those? What does that look like? Well, the new regional ponds are paid for with 50% from swim pack fees and 50% from your normal utility fees that people pay every month. But what's been happening actually is you're building the ponds on the front end, but the development has not kept up with the funds coming in to actually pay for those ponds. And so you're taking money from your utility operating to pay for those ponds instead. And if you look on page 12, it shows you what that cash flow looks like, and it's been negative for some time, and is projected just to grow. And so, because you have to build the ponds up front before the development occurs, you're counting on future development to repay those monies to that utility, and they segregate it so that they understand what portion of growth is driving and what portion is contributing. So what conclusions did we come to? Well, first, it's not as exciting as a new arena. We thought We didn't get that on the slide because we're sitting here.
This is cat's meow.
I'm 100% sure we're going to do stormwater management.
But the existing rates aren't sufficient to fund your CIP and your MS4 permit requirements. That's fairly clear. The 3% rate increases could fund about two-thirds of that CIP, leaving about $6.8 million unfunded. 6.5% increases would fund all of the maintenance-related items in the CIP, but none of the growth-related items. 10.75 would fund all of the maintenance items and the new stormwater ponds. And that your swim pack fees are lower than those of most rapidly growing cities, except Blaine, and which Patty explained, where the developers construct all the improvements to fund growth.
Questions? Comments?
Mr. What's the issue if you fall behind on some of the MS4 permit requirements?
You would be fined. I'm not sure exactly the amount of the fines, but as a permit that you hold from the state of Minnesota issued an authority of the Clean Water Act by the EPA, and be like your wastewater plant, if you fail to meet certain requirements, they do fine you. But I wouldn't know what the amount of those fines would be.
So have we ever fallen behind on any of the permit requirements before at all?
None in the past, but you have new requirements now under the new permit.
No.
We've never fallen behind at all.
No.
Are they?
We're just into the second year of the newer permit, and that's where the obligations really are a lot more stringent than they were in the first year, first permit period.
And is this all cities in Minnesota, or just that have the same requirements, or is it just the larger cities that are cities of first class?
It's the urbanized areas of greater than 50,000 people.
Okay.
Actually, they're going to get to the other areas and going down the list. It started at greater than 100,000, then they work their way down, and eventually they will make their way down the list. But it's just been a huge undertaking to get the larger cities under control first.
Okay. Other questions, comments?
It's interesting, your slide 24, number 5. How many other cities require the developers to construct the stormwater? The stormwater improvements, I wonder.
I don't know. Blaine was kind of unique in that regard. I'm not aware of any others off the top of my head, but we haven't done a lot of research on that item. But that was kind of surprising to us because most of the places we know have a stormwater charge, sometimes called a connection fee, even though really not connecting per se, but they have a stormwater charge that funds the requirements of infrastructure related to growth, whether it be a pond or pipes or pump stations, whatever they might be.
We've done that.
I suppose the Rochester area builders would be really excited about that one.
Well, we've done that. We have quite a few stormwater ponds in the past that developers constructed. Some of them end up coming back to the city when
they don't pay the taxes on them, so they're back to the city.
The other thing that happens with the ponds, of course, they're not maintenance-free, and so usually they turn over to the city who's responsible for the maintenance. About a year ago, there was an article in the Star Tribune in the Twin Cities Metro. They figured there's $1 billion of maintenance needed on the stormwater ponds because you imagine sand, the sediments get in, they fill up, and then that sediment contains things you can't just dig it up and put it anywhere you want. Oil, antifreeze, other chemicals that are locked up in that. And so that's going to be kind of a fairly large issue from people who have a number of ponds.
Okay. Mr. Quenville, could you reiterate what's the ask? What's the question before it'll come before the council?
The rate increase, whether what amount it would be, whether or not you have any at all, or if you do have any rate, what would it be?
And my understanding, the target has traditionally been for the new development, developers are paying 50% and everyone else is paying 50%?
Yeah, the utility fund pays 50%.
And is that actually where the numbers have been landing then? Or?
No, let me go back to 1997 when the council adopted that policy. And the reason was because under the anticipated stormwater permits that were coming out shortly thereafter, the developed portion of the city was also going to have to meet stormwater management as it related to rate in particular. And there was no way we were going to build a stormwater pond out here in the parking lot to handle the runoff from this complex. And so we basically determined that by building new regional ponds in new development, we would cap basically to offset the cost of building ponds in developed areas by making them larger in developing areas versus already developed areas. So that's why the 50% came in, that the general population, if you will, all the customers of the utility would pay half of the cost of a regional stormwater pond that serves stormwater from newly developing areas, but offset them what would have been an expense to the developed areas of the community.
All right, that sounds very reasonable to me. I mean, the existing customers are getting some benefit from this.
Yes.
You know, whereas in the sewer, the existing customers get absolutely no benefit from it.
All right. Questions, comments?
Just a couple of comments. It wasn't in the report. The full report, I sent the link to you. It's on the city webpage. Stormwater utility is a $68 million asset utility. We have $68 million in asset there. And we haven't been able to keep up with the maintenance activities with the fact that we haven't had a rate increase since 2011. Utility funding has been structured working with Stephen and Dale, such that it's a pay-as-you-go for capital. Only as much money as available from the rates that we raise can be used for capital projects once the bills related to operations have been paid for. And so by being capped, if you will, at a rate increase, we're just falling further behind on the maintenance activities because additional revenue is not coming in. And Mark, you're correct in the fact that there has been a little bit of growth, so there'd be a 1% increase in revenues, but that doesn't offset, you know, what the capital needs are for maintaining what we need to do. Now, Nick pointed out there are requirements under the new permit, and that is to bring the existing facilities up to the new treatment standards, because now it's not just rate, it's also volume reduction and nutrient control. We have to remove fecal coliform and suspended solids from stormwater. So there's an element of treatment here that we can accomplish through retrofitting of the existing facilities. And that's a requirement under the new permit. So there's this ongoing permit obligation. There's the fact that the existing $68 million in assets, you know, some of it has been constructed, you know, 50, 60, 70, 80 years ago that needs maintenance.
So as a point of reference on the growth side, your actual revenues from your charge, your monthly charges, has gone from $4,903,000 to $4,965,000 from 2011 to 2014. So it's a very, very little growth in that, which is would only be the result of new growth in the community because you haven't raised your rates. And so as you look back, it didn't seem like a real big item. If you get much more rapid growth, though, you may...
It's pretty similar across the country in that time frame.
Yes, no, I wasn't. Right. No, I wasn't.
Right.
Chris, sorry, it was just...
Yep. Mr. Campion. Yeah, so this maintenance problem that you've identified with existing stormwater, is that covered under this 10 and a quarter, three quarters? Are you guys covering all the maintenance?
Yes.
And the backlog of maintenance activities we haven't been doing is also covered?
All the maintenance items in the CIP are covered with that rate increase.
Do we have the same stormwater regardless of the intensities of users? You know, as an apartment building, it has 60 units, pays 60 times what a single family home would pay.
It depends.
60 separate meter apartments.
They would pay 60 single family swap charges.
Mm-hmm.
If it's common property ownership, then it's calculated differently.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, you know, it's great if you're wealthy enough in this town to, you know, be a single family homeowner, but the people who are really struggling are renting, and it would be, they also, you know, the apartment buildings would have a lot less of an impact on stormwater because, frankly, it's stacked. It's, you know, if you have four floors of apartments, you have 1/4 of the stormwater impact as single family detached home, and I'd really like to see it find a way to help those folks that are really struggling financially in the community that can't afford those single-family homes, you know, to better be able to, you know, maybe come up with a separate rate for multifamily to help those folks out.
Mr.
Bill, what you're asking for is currently in place.
It is.
If they don't own the ground, then they don't pay an individual charge.
Okay, so even if they're separately metered, they're...
No, if they're separately metered, then they pay a charge.
Aren't most buildings now separately metered, though?
Most of the newer ones are.
Yeah, okay.
I just want to take an exception with what you just said, Michael.
Yeah.
There are people who are living in their single-family homes that are struggling to stay there,
mm-hmm.
just as much as those who are in apartments.
Yes.
I can take you around to 20 places that have difficulty making it, so I would appreciate that you not say that the people who live in apartments are having more difficulty than those who live in single-family.
No, and what I would say, though, is...
That's what you said.
Okay, well, then let me clarify, Mr. Bilderback, because what I will say is those people living in a single-family home do have a higher stormwater impact. And that's the key thing.
That's not what you were saying. You were saying that people who live in apartments are economically not as good shape as those who live in homes.
And there are exceptions, and in general that is true.
Your statement is not correct.
It is not correct in every case. It is mostly correct.
All right. We need to wrap this one up, Mr. Quinville.
The rate increase, I would assume you'd have to take some action. You'd have to decide whether or not you do it on a year-to-year basis or a multi-year basis. I'm sure the staff would like it to do something that automatically comes forth, but you may want to have more review every year about the capital improvements that might be proposed by the department and what sort of rate increase you might have to put in, even though it might be, you know, we have to go through the process of going through a decision to raise the rates every year. I would have a tendency to, if I was you, to do it individually.
And I'll counterpoint that. Is that
I haven't thought he would.
He set me up. Most projects take anywhere from 2 to 3 years to deliver. So we really count on, when you approve the CIP for 2016, that we basically, we're already working on 2018. We're basically doing preliminary engineering and other things like that. And so without knowing what that cash flow is, starting the public involvement process for some of these things, it's very difficult. I mean, it's almost impossible to deliver a project now within 1 year. So not knowing what the revenues are going to be and what kind of project you're looking at, particularly maintenance. I mean, maintenance is a very broad category, and we're not putting every single maintenance project in the CIP. It's not listed individually that we're going to go out and pick, you know, fix the storm catch basins at the intersection of 4th Street and 3rd Avenue. That doesn't appear in the CIP. We need some better assurance that there's a cash flow here that would help support.
Richard makes a valid point. However, Richard, you had a ton of projects that you weren't able to close out. And so, therefore, you were taking on too many to finish.
And we had some staffing issues there that were primarily the reasons for that.
I think maybe a middle ground is, I like the idea that we're projecting out over a five-year horizon, and maybe it's something that we do look at each year, but we can use kind of a rolling average so that we're always kind of looking into the future a little bit and trying to adjust our rates annually to account for some of that future investment need or future maintenance need. I'm just throwing that out there, as opposed to going strictly to annual reevaluation versus locking in today or, you know, now for a 5-year strategy. Because I do like some opportunity to take a look at the numbers.
You typically adopt these by a resolution, and you're always free at any time to come back and reconsider a rate in any resolution for any of the utilities, whether it's electric, water, sewer, stormwater.
Mm-hmm.
You can reevaluate at any time any plan that you previously adopted.
Didn't we adopt a 3-year for the sanitary sewer? We did a multi-year.
Six.
Okay. And I guess what I'm trying to do is, I understand that we can't lock in future council. What I would like to do is set up kind of an algorithm that says, here's kind of some rolling information so that whoever's elected at the time has some sort of a trend and a projection to look at, rather than maybe going through this kind of an exercise, I don't know, how often, every year potentially. I just throw that out there as kind of an alternative. Other thoughts, direction for our staff? What do you want to see in an RCA, if anything?
Sometimes I think Patty and I are like the bearer of bad news because we do a lot of utility rate studies, and we'd never come in and have people stand up and cheer, yeah, we should raise our rates.
It's not going to happen.
As we've talked about the tax levy situation, conditions, we talk with sewer rates. The percentages here are big in comparison, but if you look at page 19, the real impact of that percentage, we're talking about 70 cents a month, basically 2 cents a day. That's the impact of these increases. So, yeah, the percentage is high, but, you know, it's somewhere in the difference.
How many years are you recommending?
But, you know, again, if the council feels more comfortable with three, that's better. But the annual would be very difficult for us to have any certainty. And like I say, the lead time on some of these projects, getting the program, getting the engineering done, getting public involvement. Bailey Woodlands, how long did that take us to get?
9 years.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some of them are very controversial and require a lot of special considerations.
I would be supportive of the 6 years, because the bottom line is this isn't an optional thing. I mean, this is one of the, and we can change at times we need to, but we built this, whether or not we all agreed with it, because maybe we didn't, but we built it and we have to maintain it.
Unfortunately, I have to agree with Mr. Richard. Yeah. I mean, I don't like the idea of having to put that kind of burden on people, but he is right. We did build it. It is our responsibility to maintain it. And so, therefore, I agree with what he's saying. And I agree with doing it for six.
And this still does maintain the pay as you go. We're not looking at body.
No, I understand. Hey,
so, on the page, there's only five, I assume, because 2015 is already covered.
Right, it's a base year.
Oh, okay. I just want to make sure. I wasn't sure if there was some other 6 year form I didn't have.
Yeah. Sorry.
Others that. You're in agreement with what Mr. Roback was saying.
Okay, then we'll bring in RCA forth based on that.
All right. Good enough. Anything else for this afternoon?
Well,
so I can get up and cheer.
go back to that housing study report that we got from the foundation. Yep. And they have in there the percentage struggling with affordability, single family.
Oh, yeah. I was wondering what was